So good afternoon. I'll call the March 9th meeting of the Ag Finance and Policy Committee to order. This remote meeting will be held in accordance with House Rule 10.01. Okay, roll call, Mr. Smith.
Chair Sundin.
Here.
Vice Chair Vang.
Present.
Representative Anderson. Representative Burkle.
Burkle present.
Representative Eklund. Representative Hansen R. Representative Hansen J. Representative Cleavorn.
Cleavorn present.
Representative Lippert.
Lippert present.
Representative Lewick. Excuse. Representative Miller.
Miller present.
Representative Nelson.
Nelson present.
Representative Thompson. Representative Anderson. Representative Eklund. Representative Hansen R. We do not quite have a quorum, Mr. Chair, but I'll let you know when we do.
Okay, well, we won't make any motions until we do have a quorum, but we do have Representative Lippert present. That we can hear from the testifiers, I guess.
Mr. Chair, quorum is now present. Okay. Representative Anderson and Eklund are here.
Okay, thank you very much. In the minutes of the previous meeting, Representative Miller, would you do you have a motion?
Mr. Chair, yes, I do have a motion that we approve the minutes from the previous meeting.
Okay, you heard the motion. All in favor, say aye.
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 Any opposed? Hearing none, seeing none, thank you. Those minutes are adopted. So we have four bills on the agenda today. Given this ever-changing dynamics of the HBA1 situation, I also want to use our time at the end to get an update from the Board of Animal Health, the Department of Ag, and the turkey growers. If we stay focused, we should have adequate time to give each bill appropriate consideration and hear the update. But we may need to flow over for a few minutes if necessary to get this important information. So first up today, we have Representative Lippert. Would you like to move your bill, introduce your testifiers, and the floor is yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I move House File 3999 be considered for possible inclusion in the Supplemental Finance Bill.
Okay. Explain your bill and introduce your testifiers.
Thank you. Strong local and regional food systems are good for our communities, local economies, and for the environment. The many global disruptions we're living through right now also all point to the wisdom of strengthening local and regional food systems. 2 years of a global pandemic, Russia's invasion of Ukraine, and increasing drought and flooding due to climate change have all been showing us how big can be fragile and that we're moving into a time where we need systems that are sturdy and strong. As Ariel Kagan of the MINIAG Network said in her letter of support, what gets measured gets managed. Local and regional food systems are a vital part of our economy, our communities, and our environments, but are often left out of key reporting. So it's important to have accurate baseline information about the state of our local and regional food systems now for the sake of developing sound and effective policy going forward. This bill tasks the Department of Ag with coming up with this report, providing recommendations for the future, and provides $10,000 for the work. There are a few testifiers with me. The first on the list is Lori Cox.
Lori Cox, please identify yourself and proceed with the testimony.
Thank you so much, Chair Sundin, Chair Vang, and committee members. Thank you for your work and the opportunity to testify today. I'm Lori Cox, owner of Roots Return Heritage Farm in Carver County, where we rent our farm to new and emerging producers. Today, I speak in front of you in support of Representative Lippert's bill, House File 3999. Minnesota's local and regional food systems have been in existence and have worked to expand for our growing population and needs. State investment looking further into these systems includes impacts they have on urban, suburban, and rural economies, employment, growing methods that provide healthy soil and better water quality, and provide experiences, connections all across our state. Systems are holistic. They're not a sole aspect or element. We need a 360-degree holistic view to bring the current and future state forward. Direct-to-consumer, school, and institution producers are absolutely vital to vibrant, healthy economic development and nearby food access. The pandemic highlighted how important local healthy foods are, especially when multi-level supply chains fail. The stronger they are, the stronger we all are. A study and report to further reveal all aspects of how these systems work successfully will help uncover gaps, challenges, holdbacks, and inequities this sector of agriculture continues to face. It will in turn reveal how to appropriately identify solutions, target funding so growth can continue. Local foods producers reflect sustainability, are the basis of clean environments, tax burden reduction, and feed the world right here at home. These systems are the tangible community fabric we need to keep and make whole. Among duties and responsibilities, state statute describes the MDA's commissioner's office as promoting development of agricultural industries, collect, compile, and supply statistics info, establish a program of agricultural diversification, and promote non-traditional ag products. I respectfully ask for your support today of this bill and appreciate your intention to include these producers of agriculture so important through our state. Thank you.
Thank you, Larry Cox. Next up, we have Julia Wickham. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Julia Wickham. I work as the legislative coordinator for the Minnesota Farmers Union, and I'm here to share our support for Representative Lippert's bill to develop a report and recommendations on local and regional food systems reporting. This is my first time testifying, and I'm very eager to do so on this bill specifically. Last growing season, I worked on a small family operation in southeastern Minnesota near Wabasha, grew organic vegetables. And the farm I worked on provided CSA shares for almost 80 families and also many more participating in a weekly farmers market in the Twin Cities. In addition, I worked for a nonprofit in Minneapolis that centered on land access for urban growers. Through that work, I was part of a lot of conversations among growers on how to distribute their products most effectively and efficiently to local communities, which is why we believe this bill would make an important investment in Minnesota's local and regional food systems by researching and reporting what is needed to better connect producers in Minnesota and the participants in local food sheds. And I think this report could come at a really important time. The COVID-19 pandemic disrupted our largely consolidated food system and showed the food supply chains were vulnerable to breakdowns and bottlenecks. This created both challenges and opportunities for producers selling their products in the food system. Our members are excited to take lessons from the pandemic and learn how to make our food system more resilient. The study could support data-informed growth for farmers and processors, allowing them to grow their businesses and meet the needs of consumers. So thank you again for the opportunity to testify and to Representative Lippert for his work on this and for you, Chair, and members of the committee. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. Thank you for your work.
Thank you. We have an additional testifier, Fallon Ryan, please.
Thank
identify
you.
Yourself and carry on with your testimony.
Wonderful. Thank you, Chair Sandeen and members of the committee for having me today and allowing me to speak on this very important bill. My name is Fallon Ryan. I am here on behalf of Sprout MN. I grew up and currently live in Brainerd, Minnesota, and I work for a nonprofit food hub out of Little Falls, Minnesota, which is a nonprofit food hub in central Minnesota, I guess. I also serve as the coordinator for the central chapter of the Sustainable Farming Association, and I'm a member of the Minnesota Farmers Union, for which I've seen a lot of your faces already today, so thanks for that as well. And I will also be presenting today on behalf as a facilitator for the newly formed Mini Ag Network, which is a network of community-rooted farm and food services and systems organizers that prioritize agricultural practices that nourish people and the planet. I'm here today to talk about House File 3999, which is a wonderful bill that would put forward a report on localized and regional food systems. To really support a sustainable and equitable food system, we really need to have metrics and data that accurately reflect the entire landscape of Minnesota agriculture. We've really seen a need to strengthen our local and regional food systems after going through this pandemic and with recent major weather events, as well as more recent worldwide events such as the Ukrainian conflict and such. I personally work with about 60 small family farms every year that distribute within our rural area of Region 5. These farmers are fantastic stewards of the land and work incredibly hard to put forward food for the tables of our fellow Minnesotans. Their production is truly crucial to our rural economy, agricultural land preservation, and happy tummies everywhere. And we really should have information collected so we have a better understanding of how to support this. And I would again reiterate that data is important in understanding where we are currently and how we move forward to support the development of this as we go forward and provide a strong and resilient Minnesota and a Minnesota food system. Thank you again, Chair Sandine and members of the committee for hearing my testimony, as rambling as it was.
Okay, my thanks to the testifiers. Any questions from the committee to the testifiers or the author? Okay. Seeing no questions from the committee, we'll make note that there's a number of letters in support of this bill, and please pay attention to them as well. Representative Lippert, any closing comments before we lay your bill over?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we heard clearly that there's a lot of exciting activity happening in local and regional foods, and it's important to have clear and accurate data and information to keep strengthening this part of our agriculture in Minnesota. So thanks for the time, and hope this can be included in the bill.
Okay, let me get the numbers right here now. There's been a little bit of a mix-up. Okay, House File 3999 is laid over. Next up, we have Representative Keel. House File 3212, I'll move the bill. We have about 15 minutes blocked for this bill. Representative Anderson, would you like to move the bill? And it'll be laid over for possible inclusion in the supplemental finance bill.
It is my pleasure, Mr. Chair, to move the bill.
Okay, thank you, Representative Anderson. Welcome to the committee, Representative Keel. Tell us about your bill and introduce your witnesses, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Good to be back in Ag Committee. It's like coming home. Very important. House File 3212 is to address an appropriation that we passed back in 2019. The legislature appropriated $5 million for an Ag Innovation Campus located in Crookston. That investment made by the Minnesota State Legislature has had a massive impact. The investment has been added to by groups such as MSGA, MSR, and PC, AURI, USB, Pheasants Forever, NCI, AMS, and many more. Backed by the loan for local lending institution, phase one of this project is well on its way to being completed. The project started and with a professional developed budget using competitive bids. The cost to build phase one in 2020 was $10 million. Because of its added costs caused solely by the COVID project, construction costs are now 35% over budget, bringing the cost of phase one to $13,500,000. So our lending group has reached their own loan limit and has generously, so has the generosity of the building companies that we are contracting with. House File 3212 proposes to appropriate $2 million from the State Recovery Federal Fund to the A1C to cover increased construction costs related to COVID. We have also been working with the administration and the Minnesota Department of Agriculture and are hopeful that this funding will be included in the Governor Waltz's amended supplemental budget. And I'd also like to add, Mr. Solenka is here also to talk about it, but I would like to, as a resident of this area of Minnesota, remind my colleagues that this area is not just about soybeans. Granted, soybeans are Polk County, that is part of District 1B, is the largest growing soybean county in Minnesota. But there are a lot of different crops grown here, a lot of rotations. We do see corn, but we have wheat, edibles. I call them edibles, but think white or pink, navy beans, different beans, potatoes. If you go way up into Representative Burkle's district, grass seed is also grown in this area. But the importance of Ag Innovation Campus is to extend more research abilities for that products we have growing in Minnesota in general. And this is a very important research project, as well as advancing the soybean industry in our area. So with that, I will ask if we can acknowledge Mr. Solenka.
Mr. Solenka, would you please introduce yourself and name and position and continue with the testimony?
Yes. Chairman Sundin, members of the committee, thank you very much for taking time to listen to this important project. My name is Tom Solenka. I'm CEO for Ag Management Solutions. We are the group that is managing the Ag Innovation Campus. I'm acting as CEO for the Ag Innovation Campus during this development phase. And I'm pleased to be able to report not only on our need to for completion, but really what has been completed to date with the generosity of Minnesota Legislature, the Governor, and the Department of Ag. This is a very important project. In fact, it's the only project like it in the world, and I say that with extreme confidence. We are building a small crush plant, but what's most important about this crush plant is about the research and the development of workforce and to be able to help small and medium-sized companies through that very treacherous phase of getting to commercialization known as the Valley of Death. And that valley is where a lot of really great projects that are developed at universities like the University of Minnesota, they come off of a benchtop example, whether it be a new variety, a new process technology, and they try to make their way to commercialization. That phase is extremely complicated and extremely expensive. And in agriculture, it's even more so because there's such a limited availability of places that new varieties can be tested and proven at a scale large enough that large companies like ADM, AGP, CHS, Cargill will really want to look at that new type of crop and put it into their system. This campus, the Ag Innovation Campus, will comprise of a crush plant, which is going to process about 9 truckloads of soybeans every day, which is not a very large amount in the scale of many of the large plants, say the 2 in Mankato. But it is a large enough amount to where those plants would look at this facility and say, okay, if you can do it there, we can do it at our locations. And along with that crush plant is maybe the most important part of it, which is there are two other phases, which will be the office phase, which is much more than just an office. It's a training facility, and it'll be laboratories that will be managed by AURI that will help these new projects through that Valley of Death again, because every time you're bringing a new product online, there's testing and modifications and retesting that has to occur. If that can all be done in one facility, the speed to market will be dramatically increased. And then the third part of this project is the research base. And those bays will be 75 by 50 foot research bays attached directly to the crush plant. The importance of that is that new processing technologies will be able to prove themselves out in that research bay with the feedstock created in the crush plant. Now, a facility like this doesn't really exist anywhere And then on top of it, to announce that this is going to be a non-for-profit, it certainly doesn't exist. So any profits that are generated from the crush plants will be then available for research projects to be able to come through the facility. On top of all of this great research, this facility is going to be a training center to create high-paying jobs and skilled workers that are needed in our region. And there'll be workers that can be utilized within the food processing sector as well as agriculture sector. Right now, there isn't a program where individuals can get hands-on training at the type of equipment that they'll ultimately be having their career in. And it's one of the pinnacles of this facility is workforce development. So we're very excited about having a facility that's going to be able to do all three of these things as the full facility comes online. Unfortunately, due to COVID, as Representative Keel has explained, we have run into some real headaches with the price of the equipment, the cost of bringing all of this together, and we are running roughly 35% below what we had anticipated. So just a little more help is needed. All of these costs can be identified directly to the increase in costs since COVID. We had a full budget, full professional budget worked out. We had contractors online, and then COVID hit, and now we have this dramatic increase in cost. So with just a little more push over the line, this facility will be up and running. We'll be crushing 2022 beans in the winter and spring of 2023. So it is a shovel-ready project like we've never seen as far as it's ready to go. The board of directors who had intended to be with me here today, they ran into some travel issues. Are from that area, and they would testify today that not only have they decided and have the land developed, they have the building purchased, they have the processing equipment purchased, but as of last week, contracted for the grain handling facility as well. And that was the last piece to make sure that this project is really going to come online and hit its deadline. We're extremely proud of all of the help that we've gotten from everybody from this group on through industry. And of course, the checkoff organizations that have come online to help this project. We're getting support not from Minnesota, not from the region out in the four-state region, not even just within the United States, but we're getting support and encouragement from companies all over the world because this type of facility just simply doesn't exist. This will move Minnesota into a phase of agriculture that has not had the chance to be the leader in some time. And we're extremely proud about what this is going to do for all of Minnesota. And of course, the Crookston region is going to be particularly a beneficiary of the good jobs that are going to be able to come out of this facility. I thank you for your time and I welcome any questions about the project.
Thank you, Mr. Slaneka. Stay on deck here. We also have department professionals available for questions if needed. So are there any questions for the testifier or the author? Representative Chair Hansen, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's confusing to me why the federal ARP funding is being tapped here versus perhaps general fund or bonding. We just passed, I think maybe it's today or yesterday, the 1 year anniversary of ARP being passed. And thankfully that happened a year ago with President Biden's leadership. So I'm just wondering why we're tapping that for this.
Okay, that one's up for grabs. To the author, testifier, or the department professionals?
Mr. Chair, this is Representative Keel. I would say that what we started to, what I addressed to the beginning is that it was purely because of the COVID issues that our costs ran high. Unfortunately, this project would have been well on its way had COVID not hit, and it is anyway, but I mean, it would have been farther along, I believe, and that is a route to go to be able to fund this program.
Is there a follow-up, Chair Hansen? Okay, thank you. Representative Anderson, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Keel, this is a worthwhile project, a good project. And either you or Mr. Slonica could comment on the exciting future for soybeans with in regard to renewable diesel. I've heard reports that we may need as many as 40 million additional acres of soybeans within 5 or 6 years to satisfy that demand for renewable diesel. Would there be any work done in that area in this new plant up in Crookston?
I believe so, but Mr. Slonica, maybe you would like to respond.
Mr. Slonica?
Slonica.
Yes, Chair, Mr. Keel, and Representative Anderson. So this facility is not only going to help the processing of this added amount of soybeans that are going to be needed in order to fill the renewable diesel standard. Now, the renewable diesel standard is going to drive a lot of changes in agriculture, and it's going to help the environment in a dramatic way. This fuel is completely fungible with diesel fuel across the world. And while electrics may be the future for quite a while now longer, we're going to need to fly fuel-powered airplanes and diesel trucks and tractors across our fields. And so we need to help figure out how to make that fuel better, with less of an impact, and also with other crops. So one of the features of the Ag Innovation Campus is that while it's going to start on soybeans, it's also going to be able to process cover crops, which is the holy grail of being able to sequester carbon in an affordable economic agriculture system. So this facility is going to be able to help to advance agriculture and also advance our ability to create better fuels for the future.
Thank you very much.
Any follow-up, Representative Anderson?
No, Mr. Chair, thank you. That was a very concise answer and well said.
Great. Chair Vang.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Keel, it seems like this is like a public-private partnership. Wondering if there are matching funds attached to this $2 million?
Mr. Slonica?
Yes, Chair Keel and Representative Yang. So there are matching funds attached in that the organization is receiving fundings from corporate and private dollars. As well as a very large bank loan that is going to help stabilize it. So by no means is this fully a public project. It is public and private from its financing standpoint, and it will continue to do so. As the facility is up and running, which is what we're hoping to get consolidated here very quickly, the industry will be able to see that it's real. So industry is very reluctant to invest in future projects unless it's something within their own industry, or I should say within their own business platform. And once it's up and running and we can demonstrate them and we can physically show them how this works, we believe that more corporate dollars will come in. We've got indications from several major ag corporations and some outside of agriculture that will want to tour very quickly and be able to also give to the project. That's also why it's important that it is a non-for-profit, because that also allows ease in getting dollars from these corporations, foundations, and various funding mechanisms.
Okay, any follow-up on that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering what that number is for the matching.
Mr. Slonica.
Well, currently the project is $13.5 million, and of that, depending on the decision of this committee, all but $7 million of that is coming from private entities and the checkoff organizations and the bank loans. So it's about 50-50 at this point.
Anything further, Chair Vang?
That's all. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Cleburne, please.
Good
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think this is really to Representative Keel. Representative Keel, is my memory correct? Did Senator Smith come out in support of these payments? Do you remember?
Representative Keel.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cleaver, not to my knowledge, that might have been the case. I've not kept track of who in the federal area is supporting this. It is it is an innovative, as the name says, very important project for agriculture in Minnesota. And like he said, it's very unique to the area. So I would hope that our senators and congressmen would, congresswomen would support this program. You know, Minnesota agriculture is a huge part of our economy. And I would really like to impress upon everyone that soybeans provide a lot of different products in our world. Certainly, as Representative Anderson pointed out, how that is biodiesel is really important, and we're not going to walk away from that agriculturally for a while, if ever. So, but I do not know, Representative Cleaverne, if maybe Mr. Yes. As I noticed his, I guess he's still there.
Yes.
He's getting a week, so.
Yeah, for some reason, I'm thinking that, Representative Keel. And I just want to, you know, as a strong supporter of the Forever Green platform, you know, to talk about the abilities to use this facility for cover crops and for the crusher to be used in that capacity as well, and for those cover crops, some of them also to become biofuels as we go forward. I would just ask that as we do these investments, to understand that we also have to do the investments for the science to get those cover crops where they need to be. So I see it as potentially complementary to the cover crops platform. And so I just want to make sure that we're supportive of the entire picture. And I would ask for the committee to keep that in mind as we go forward. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair, can I just add?
Representative Keel, a couple of comments, and we need to move on.
Sure. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. I would echo Representative Cleaverne's comments. If you have been to the University of Minnesota Crookston, Northwest Experiment Station, those things are ongoing and have been for years. And so this is why this program is so important, this facility is so important. It just even explodes our possibilities for agriculture and what we're looking at. So thank you very much, members, and I hope you consider this.
Okay, thank you.
Yep.
House File 3212 is laid over. Next up, we have Representative Nelson. 3878.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I believe the motion on this is laying it over, if I remember correctly.
Yes.
But
that's your motion.
So I would move that this bill would be laid over for possible inclusion. This 3878 is a bill that is would be adding two members to the Food Safety and Security Defense Task Force. And these two members would have knowledge in cybersecurity. And it's something that we've seen a growing threat of over the years. And JBS, one of the largest meat producers, about a year ago had been attacked with ransomware, and they were shut down for about 2 days. And then just in our kind of our own backyard here, Crystal Valley Co-op back on September 19th had been attacked with ransomware and shut down their ability to use credit cards, and it, you know, kind of disrupted their co-op operations for a few days until ransomware had been or till a ransom had been paid, or however that was cleared up there. And you know, probably many of us remember the Colonial Pipeline, while it's not related to food, but the Colonial Pipeline attack that had happened and stopped the flow of fuel and stuff like that on the kind of the eastern seaboard, and the disruption that happened there. And the reason I bring this forward, is I think we're going to continue to see more and more cyber attacks. I think many of us remember 9/11 and, you know, just the physical terrorism that we saw that day. And this was kind of the idea that this task force was designed after the rollout of that, of, you know, the act, you know, terrorist acts that were done, you know, whether deliberately to food or you know, airlines or whatever. But, you know, the idea of this would protect our food supply and our food chain and making sure that we have food, you know, that it's safe and able to freely flow through our country. And one of the things that I think is, you know, even this meeting right here, where it's all over the internet, it's being held virtually, and, you know, our world has changed. And the threats against our society and our food system have changed. And, you know, cyber is one of the biggest things. And I think as we see the conflict between Russia and Ukraine and the invasion there, we know that there's many of these ransomware places are housed in Russia, and, you know, some of the people that run the dark web. And I think that it's very likely that we're going to could possibly see some growth of cyber attacks and what that can do to our food supply, whether it's simply, you know, a grocery store can't get their order in for what they need for supplies for that week, you know, the food for their shelves or whatever. So I do believe there's a testifier, Tamara, from AgriGrowth. I believe she's here to testify. And I think the Department of Agriculture is also available to comment. And so I think if we could, if we could hear from Tamara first, please.
Tamara Nelson, please state your name, identify yourself, and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to testify today. My name is Tamara Nelson, and I'm Executive Director of the Minnesota AgriGrowth Council. We're a nonprofit, nonpartisan member organization, and we have members from the entire food chain, from individual farmers to co-ops to Fortune 500s. Our members are very diverse in size and structure and the products and services they offer, but they do play a very critical role in bringing Minnesota products not only to our folks here, but also to federal and global markets. The agri-food sector in Minnesota is our state's second largest economic driver. It is also a sector that, as was mentioned by Representative Nelson, had faced numerous cybersecurity attacks in 2021. He mentioned JBS, but the other one that directly affected our state was Crystal Valley Co-op. And there were several smaller ones, obviously, on individual farmers and small business. Our 2021 Ag and Food Summit in November featured a panel of cybersecurity experts, and they did a great job of providing guidance, but they also warned us of the need to remain vigilant and to keep learning and to keep improving and protecting our system. We strongly support the addition of two cybersecurity experts to the Minnesota Food Safety and Defense Task Force. We work closely with the University of Minnesota Food Security, Food Defense Institute, and with others here in Minnesota. Mr. Chair and committee members, we heartily endorse this bill, and we thank you and are happy to answer any questions.
Okay, I'll make a note at this point that there is a fiscal note being prepared for this bill, and we'll have it completed before we make any final decisions on this. We'll be laying it over today. So any further testimony?
I had spoken with, Mr. Chair, I had spoken with Commissioner Peterson yesterday, and I don't know if he's here today. The department is... So if he's here and wants to talk, he can. Otherwise, or if there's somebody from the Department of Ag that wants to speak, otherwise, I could just share a little bit. The department is neutral on this bill. They see the need for it, and they've utilized the defense, you know, this task force. They used it quite a lot over the last 2 years in just, making sure our food supply was safe during coronavirus. And, you know, had Commissioner Peterson had met most of the time weekly with them and just kind of understanding more of what was happening. And what if there's anyone, I don't know if anyone's from the Department of Ag here that wants to comment.
Thank you. Commissioner Peterson, do you have anything to enlighten us with?
Mr. Chairman and members, Tom Peterson, Commissioner of Minnesota Department of Agriculture. And as Representative Nelson said, and Ms. Nelson, that's confusing. As Nelson said, you know, cybersecurity is a concern. You know, when we had the couple issues in Minnesota, they are very concerning. You know, as we looked at it, we work with DPS and Homeland Security and others, working on those. You know, a couple of quick comments that I might have is we would not sure we need two. And so just working through, going through, there's an appointed one, and then there's one appointed by the governor, one appointed by the department. And so I don't know if we need two, would be one suggestion. And then just picking like how we find somebody as an expert in that would be one of the thoughts. We also have Catherine Simon, our division director, on. I don't know if she has any other comments on the bill, but, you know, happy to work with Representative Nelson on it.
Great. It's an important issue, and I'm glad people are working on it. Any further testimony? Okay. Hearing none, seeing none. Oh, excuse me, Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I think I put my hand down instead of putting it up, but just a quick question for anybody who can answer, Representative Nelson or Commissioner Peterson. So, yeah, I support adding these two members to this commission. But up to this point, have we had none? And there certainly must be an ongoing effort to keep track of this because it is a very serious situation. So what do we have going up to this point in terms of cybersecurity? Commissioner Peterson, possibly.
Commissioner Peterson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, on the committee, there are representatives of many major companies or several bigger companies like within the that are aware of like their plans and overall and different things that they can share. It hasn't been a discussion that we've had to my knowledge with the committee, but Ms. Simon, I see her as her hand raised and she might be able to add some to that. But there are people that are aware of, they're not necessarily experts, but they might be with a large grocery chain or a food distributing company that sit on the committee that are aware of their company's strategies and able to, you know, contribute. As Representative Nelson said, the committee was very helpful to me when we were in there, two years ago. I was meeting with them every week, every Monday afternoon at 3 o'clock, I remember well, to kind of give us an update on where bread was coming from or hamburger as we had empty shelves and just making sure we were getting the food everywhere we had. So it's a nice mix that we have on the committee. Committee's been around for a long time. Most states have, 30 some states, I think, have a food safety task force. And, you know, it's a interesting committee. But I don't know if Ms. Simon has anything to add to as well.
Hey, Catherine Simon, please identify yourself and let's hear from you.
I'm Catherine Simon, the Food and Feed Safety Director for the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. Thank you, Chair, and the group today. The two points that I'll just clarify is, at this point, there's been no specific conversation dedicated towards cybersecurity, so not opposed to moving in that direction. But as Commissioner Peterson said, it's a pretty broad group, and there has been a lot of focus on resiliency in the system in general. So. With that in mind, again, just the clarification on if there's a particular reasoning behind the two members. Currently, the other appointed members, it's one per category. So just to make sure that we're able to fill with the clear intent. The other clarification, right now there is no funding for our task force. There is not funding provided with the original initiation of it in statute. Right now we use some grant funding from the FDA to support that work, as well as the coordination of that staff member who does a number of other activities related to outreach too. So, getting more intent about the purpose and the intent so that we can fill out that fiscal note appropriately would be appreciated too. Like I said, there's no specific conversations related to cybersecurity so far. However, we do have membership and representation from the University of Minnesota with experts in the field of food defense. And that has been the focus of the last couple of workshops that have been provided have been in the area of food dispense from some standard curriculum that's available. So I do know that it has been part of the focus.
Well, thank you all for a great discussion here. Looking forward to hearing more on this. Representative Nelson, any closing comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess to Ms. Simon, probably also Commissioner Peterson, my thoughts originally had been, you know, and I'm fine with a one, you know, if we just add one member to it. My original thought was that we have, you know, there was nine of them are appointed by the governor. And then there's two that are, you know, just or a member that is from the University of Minnesota. And so it was just really just trying to give a balance there. But, you know, I think if one individual was adequate, I think that's, I think that's a change that I'm open to. And I would appreciate your support as we move this forward and hopefully we can get this adopted. So thank you.
Okay, thank you, Representative Nelson. House File 3878 is laid over. Next up, we have Chair Hansen. This bill had a fiscal note completed and does have a fiscal impact and will need to be laid over. This may generate a little more discussion, so we have about 20 minutes blocked for this or so. Chair Hansen, please move your bill and begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I would move House File 3751 be laid over for possible inclusion. And I do have a author's amendment. It's a DE3 amendment.
Okay, do you want to explain your amendment, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And members, if you want to look online, we did find in researching this that there is not anywhere in Minnesota state statute where plastic is defined. Kind of stunning. But looking in definitions around the country for other states with plastic, and I'm not speaking only for agriculture here, but plastic in general is not defined in Minnesota statute. Plastic, what we do is define plastic, plastic-coated pesticide, plastic-coated fertilizer, and then we prohibit those with effective dates in 2024 and 2025. The non-agricultural fertilizer and pesticide plastic would be January 1st, 2024, and then the agricultural fertilizers and pesticides will be effective January 1st, 2025. So okay. I would like to move that D3 amendment to get in the shape I would like as the author.
Any questions to the author on the DE3? Okay, seeing none, hearing none, all those in favor of the DE3 amendment signified by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. Okay, that motion prevails. That amendment is adopted. Chair Hansen, further comments before we go to testimony? If not, we only have one person signed up to testify.
So members and Minnesotans watching at home, healthy soils are not healthy when they're littered with plastic. That when we are purposefully putting plastic and spreading it over thousands of acres, year after year, the plastic does not break down completely. Even if it does break down, it breaks down into smaller pieces. Over the last several years, there's been a deluge of scientific reports about the impacts on microplastics and plastics in water, in food, and in people. In the published, posted material, there's two articles from the Guardian about impacts of plastics and trying to prevent plastic pollution. So I understand and I'm fully aware that there are plastic-coated particles that are fertilizer or pesticides, or a combination of fertilizers and pesticides that are applied, and one of their purposes is to make it be slow release. But after the active ingredient is gone, the plastic remains. And what happens to that plastic? What happens to that plastic? It stays in the soil year after year, or it washes off and washes into water. I have yet to find anyone who wants to eat or drink plastic. Several years ago, we prohibited plastic in personal products like facial scrubs or shampoos, because purposely putting microplastics into those products ended up in our water. And when it ends up in our water, it gets consumed by the smallest creatures, who then get consumed by larger creatures, and it moves up the food chain. There's also recent research that shows that it's in us. So we have to reduce plastic pollution. And that includes where we're purposefully putting it into the soil. If we're going to have healthy soils, we have to reduce our plastic pollution in those soils. And that is the intent of my bill.
Okay, thank you. I see we have Sarah Erickson. Would you please state your name, who you represent, and share your concerns?
Thank you, Chair Sundin and Chair Hansen. My name is Sarah Erickson. I'm here today representing Scott's Miracle-Gro. Scott's Miracle-Gro and related products are found around the world here in Minnesota in both our mom-and-pop hardware stores and our big-box retailers. The Scott's Miracle-Gro family of brands are among the most recognized in the world. Scott's has been in business since 1868 and is continually focused on innovation and introducing new and enhanced product formulations utilizing the best science available. Scott's is a proud advocate in both the protection and water quality and quantity. In this case, we are unclear about the definition of some terms in the bill. And thank you, Chair Hansen, for that amendment that defines plastics. I appreciate it. Although we continue to have some concerns, this bill may have an adverse impact on products we currently sell. And Representative Hansen, you did correctly identify an example that I was going to use, which is we use certain polymers in home lawn and garden products that allow for the slow release of nitrogen. And these polymers slow down the release of that nitrogen, not only to meet the plant's needs, but more importantly, they prevent excess nutrients from being swept into lakes and streams. There's a number of similar products used in commercial, home, and agriculture settings that also use polymers to mitigate environmental risk. Scott's hasn't taken a position on this bill yet because we're here to better understand the intent and definitions in the bill. We're wondering what is meant by the term readily biodegradable and if polymers in this case would be considered plastic. And again, Representative Hansen, I appreciate your amendments and we will take a look at that. We had spoken to House Research previously and didn't believe that those two pieces were defined, and I think you identified that one of them or both of them wasn't and attempted to define plastic with your amendment. And we would hope to work with you in the future to have a better understanding of this intent and the scope and the application of this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I stand for questions.
Thank you, Sarah Erickson. Chair Hansen, can you help us out with the concerns of the of Sarah Erickson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Ms. Erickson. I think the DE3 will help define that so that term readily biodegradable is not there. We did work with NCSL to try to find definitions, and that's where we were able to find the definition of plastic. Surprisingly, throughout the country, there are very limited definitions of plastic. So I think I'd be happy to work with you on clarifying. You know, we want to make sure that we're keeping plastic out of the water and stuff that does not, that continues to stay in the soil or can be brought up by living organisms and transferred up the food chain. So it is being laid over, and I think that gives the opportunity to work on this to help clarify. And if we are making definitions that are around the country, we want to make sure we're accurate. And I don't know if that helps out or not.
Okay, Okay. Thank you very much. Just a reminder to the committee, we have the department on tap here as well for to help us with their thought process. Any questions or comments for the testifier or the author? I see Nathan Nelson, Representative Nelson, has his hand up.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the author, I do have some concerns about this because I think, you know, as and it's kind of pointed out in the DA3, I think that's the number, but, you know, with the difference of what is a polymer and a plastic, and it's my understanding that all plastics are, let's see if I'm saying this right, that all plastics are polymers, but not all polymers are plastic. And, you know, I think that's probably an important distinction because I think we're looking over seed coatings or fertilizer. On my farm, and I'm in the CSP program, and I have to use a polymer-coated nitrogen because it's a time release. It, helps put the fertilizer there when it needs it. It's, making the best use of it. And so I think, in some ways we do have to, make sure that we're doing this correct and, not prohibiting something that is a benefit to the environment, even, weighing them out. And, the research is continuing to improve on this, and we're continuing to move forward on making better products, making better utilizes of it. I mean, I think of the difference on our farm today versus, what my grandfather did, 50 years ago. And we tilled just under 4% of our farm. All of it is no-till, and much of that is today because of the advancements that we've been able to have, whether it's in fertilizer, or seed coatings, or others that have been able to minimize the reduction of we're reducing the amount of nutrients used as well because we're keeping them in place and having it at the seed, at the plant for the right time. And I think that's important. And I really don't want to be moving backwards into the 1950s where we plowed all fall. We had erosion issues. We had significant problems because we used plowing and tillage and what at the time was the best management practices. Well, they've improved. They've changed. And I think we need to be continuing to work on that and continuing to work on what is best. And, this bill does bring up some things that I think we need to continue to work on our stewardship and best management. And, just human life does have a cost and an effect on the environment. And I think all of us have a goal of minimizing that, minimizing the negative effect. And I think we need to continue this conversation, but at the same time, I do think we need to have a strong discussion on what a polymer is versus a plastic and where that is. So I guess that's kind of my comments for right now.
Okay, thank you. I didn't see a question in there, so thanks for your input, though. Representative Anderson, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, here we go again, a major restriction being proposed on production agriculture. Representative Hansen, in looking at this, what percentage of plastics in the environment today or in current times are made up of these microencapsulated particles that you're attempting to regulate here?
Representative Hansen, Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson. I think to use a phrase that Representative Lippert referenced, you can't manage what you can't measure. So we don't have the data on that. But to go back to what Representative Nelson said, back in the 1950s, we didn't have plastic covered or encapsulated fertilizers and pesticides. This is a relatively new phenomenon of using plastic, petroleum-based plastics for delivery. And the issue here is, in the last 5 years, we've learned about plastic pollution. We did, you may remember when we voted on reducing or eliminating that in personal products. But we have a huge amount of plastic, and plastic use increased with COVID, disposable plastics. But what this is purposely putting plastics into the environment in production. And yes, there are benefits with that slow release. It helps out on water quality. But the plastic itself provides pollution. The plastic itself is a pollutant. That's what's different. We don't have a handle on it. And that's why we have in the DE3 amendment a phase in on eliminating it, because it's probably out there in existing stock.
Mr. Chair?
Follow-up, Representative Anderson.
Well, Ms. Representative Hansen, your phase in on production agriculture, I believe, is 3 years, and I've read that they're looking at this in Europe and estimating that it's going to take at least 10 years to come up with replacements for these polymer coverings. So are you advocating going backward in terms of, well, let's talk about the fertilizer application, going backward in terms of the nitrogen being released into our groundwater and into surface water?
Response, Chair Hansen?
Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, no. I think that our innovation and creativity is going to increase. We are investing greatly in research throughout this budget, through both AGREET and AGRI on production agriculture. This is something that I think can be worked on. I also think that we are going to see great change very quickly in the fertilizer sphere because of the conflict with Russia and Ukraine. When we are forced to make a change because of world events, we have adapted quickly as a country. And I think we will be able to do that again and solve this problem of keeping plastic out of our water, out of our soil, out of our food, and out of ourselves.
Representative Hansen or Anderson?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Well, I guess I respectfully disagree that the war in the Ukraine is going to hasten breakthroughs in fertilizer. We're not going to be able to afford it the way things are going right now, and we might be back to the basics of whatever. But, you know, your bill, I think, is sensationalized in that you call for a total ban or blackout of these products in two years and 3 years. Maybe a study would be more appropriate. I think the bill contains way too much uncertainty. There are so many terms here that are not well defined. And I was looking at the fiscal note, and you know, fiscal notes usually are a pretty dry reading, but I underlined some of the concerns in the fiscal note, and I almost ran out of ink, you know, such as use of quoted nitrogen fertilizer is a best management practice, and now you're advocating going away from that in 3 years. And it's safer for the user to have this encapsulated product. And just the uncertainties with how do we measure these? A lot of these inert ingredients are proprietary information with the manufacturers, and just getting that information and determining what is in fact to be determined to be rated or tested or banned, and what is a easily biodegradable product. Again, there's too many things here that need more additional definitions, and for that reason, I certainly can't support the bill as it stands right now, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Well, thanks for your discussion. I guess we'll move to final comments from the Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. As I mentioned before, I have yet to find somebody that wants to drink or eat plastic. Plastic pollution is a very complex and a very big problem. But when we purposely put plastic into the environment, it has an impact over thousands of acres. We need to start this conversation to reduce plastic pollution.
Okay, thank you, Chair Hansen. With that, House File 3212 is laid over. Did I get that one right? No. Excuse me. Jeez.
Chair Sundin, as amended.
3751 as amended is laid over. Okay, next up we have a discussion, some education on the HPA1 virus. We heard a lot about it, and we've got the department and professionals there in to educate us a little bit better. We have first up Dr. Beth Thompson, Executive Director. Please identify yourself and proceed with some testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, Beth Thompson, Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Animal Health and State Veterinarian. Administrator Conley, can you pull up my PowerPoint? Thank you. Thank you so much. And you can go on to the first slide, Administrator Conley. Members, this is a very important situation, and I appreciate the opportunity to share some information with you. First of all, as you all may recall, the first instance of highly pathogenic avian influenza for this current ongoing outbreak in North America occurred in Canada, Far Eastern Newfoundland, in late December of 2021. Now, avian influenza is carried by wild bird species, mainly wild waterfowl. Wild waterfowl travel in flyways. Those flyways generally run north to south and south to north, depending on the season. And the spreading of the virus across the United States from that Atlantic flyway into the Midwest, which includes the Central and Mississippi flyways, is evidenced by this map and the positive detection. So those positive detections that we found so far are those red states that are on this map. Because some of these states have had more than one detection of highly pathogenic avian influenza, I won't go through the chronological order. But I would recommend, if members are interested, the USDA has a nice web page that covers the details of each one of the detections, both in domestic and in wild birds. And Administrator Conley, if you could go to the next slide, please, a little more detail. So the World Organization for Animal Health, or the OIE, has differing definitions of facilities. So you may, during this outbreak, you may hear some folks talking about poultry and non-poultry. These are terms used by this world organization for country reporting and trade purposes. What we've done here, what I have up here in front of you, has the terms that states use and have used in the past. We're using the terms commercial and backyard flocks. So this information was pulled from a national update yesterday. There are a total of 23 cases listed. Again, as I mentioned, some states have more than one detection. They include commercial turkey, commercial broilers, layers, but we also have quite a number of backyard flocks, including what was noticed as a pet chicken flock in New York. In addition to that, there have been over 300 detections in wild birds. The surveillance is carried out in wild birds by USDA Wildlife Services. And just as an update to everyone, the virus was found in a wild goose reported out yesterday in Lincoln, Nebraska. Next slide, please. Minnesota has been preparing for highly pathogenic avian influenza, probably going back at least one, if not over one decade. We have an emergency disease management committee that has been meeting. That committee includes veterinarians, poultry owners, researchers, the veterinary diagnostic lab, extension folks, federal agencies, and then other state agencies too, including the Minnesota Department of Health, Department of Natural Resources, and our good partners at the Department of Agriculture. So everyone, communication is vital when we have a foreign animal disease in the United States. We have weekly meetings that are stood up, and we are working together with Extension and the other groups that are mentioned on the slide. Surveillance and biosecurity are really key, and that's whether we're talking about commercial flocks or backyard flocks. And then I do have to call out, again, Minnesota Department of Agriculture, the partnership that we have with them in standing up the biweekly legislative calls is truly appreciated. And then last slide, please. So it's important for everyone to remember that our poultry farmers, the veterinarians, the folks that are working on these farms do import surveillance work on an ongoing basis. This happens whether or not there's avian influenza in our country or in our area. Additionally, poultry that is properly handled and stored and cooked remains safe to eat. The Minnesota Department of Health has a zoonotic disease unit, and we know that at this point in time, this highly pathogenic avian influenza poses a low risk to the public. So the Minnesota Department of Health zoonotic unit includes veterinarians, and there is a state public health veterinarian in that unit. That group has stood up and will be monitoring all that are involved in a commercial or backyard AI outbreak, avian influenza outbreak, if it happens here in the state of Minnesota. They are also the experts that discuss human health risk of this and any zoonotic disease. And lastly, members, just so you know, we've also got hotlines available. If there are folks out in your area that are contacting you and want to know if they have the right biosecurity, if they have sick or dying birds that they want to report, on our webpage, Board of Animal Health, there are hotlines listed. You can direct them towards those hotlines. We've also listed a number for the Department of Natural Resources, again, if there's wild birds that they find that are either sick or dying. And with that, members, I'll turn it over. I believe there are Department of Ag folks, agriculture folks on the call, too. Thank you.
Yes, sir. Commissioner Peterson, you want to direct your personnel into the discussion?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Again, Tom Peterson, Commissioner of Minnesota Department of Agriculture. I'm just going to be brief and then turn it over to Lucy Hunt, our Director of Office of Emergency Preparedness and Response. And just to remember, in 2015, over 9 million birds died in Minnesota. And so just a really big hit to our economy, really important. So I just appreciate the partnership with the board, legislators, USDA, and others as we work towards this. And so I'm just going to turn it right over to Lucy and let her take it away. So if that's okay, Mr. Chair.
Please, go ahead.
Well, thank you, Chair Sundin and committee members. My name is Lucia Hunt. I am the Director of the Office of Emergency Preparedness and Response here at the MDA. I have some slides. I don't think they made it over to you in time, so if that's okay, I'll just share my screen. I guess I don't have that ability.
You should now, Ms. Hunt.
Okay. Let's get you over here. Okay. Okay. Are you seeing that?
Yes, please. Go ahead.
Okay. Okay, so it's, we've just talked about kind of the current situation with high path avian influenza, but in 2015, as you may recall, Minnesota was ground zero for the nation's worst foreign animal disease outbreak. Over 9 million birds were put down across 104 turkey farms, 5 egg layers, and 1 backyard site across the state. Our response then in 2015 took over 5 months from start to finish with the help of over 80 state employees, along with working hand in hand with federal employees as well. Together, we organized case management with individual producers. We made sure we had logistics for equipment and supplies. We handled bird depopulation and disposal, barn cleaning and disinfecting, producer indemnification and reimbursement. And in addition to that, we also issued thousands of permits to move regulated articles out of and into control areas that contained farms that were affected, not necessarily infected by the disease. And as a result, while our state saw an economic hit of about $650 million, our efforts really kept that impact from getting a whole lot bigger. Through that HPAI response, those 7 years ago, we learned a lot of lessons. The first was that it prompted the state to invest in its own equipment cache of poultry foamers and carbon dioxide delivery systems for depopulation. On an internal level, it started us down the road to create this Office of Emergency Preparedness and Response and build a multi-agency incident management team that's completely focused on agriculture emergencies. A one-time ag emergency fund was appropriated in 2016, and leaders at the MDA put together a team of full-time, part-time, and what I'll call on-demand staff to maintain situational awareness, to know what's going on around them, to evaluate these agricultural threats, and then to respond to any ag emergencies. So after a couple of years of training, exercising, and lots of planning, our team successfully responded to the 2020 supply chain disruption in the pork industry by managing two carcass disposal sites. Whether or not we are ready to respond to a foreign animal disease sometimes feels like we're aiming at a moving target. The aspects to a response that I've listed here on this slide require the cooperation from not only the Minnesota Department of Agriculture and the Board of Animal Health, but we require industry input, academic partnership, and an understanding between other states where our animal industries are shared. So due to that hard work that we, and the lessons learned from 2015 and the work in 2020, we've really earned the trust of our poultry and our pork industries and forged much stronger relationships to answer these questions. Now the request for $1.5 million in one-time general fund appropriations is proposed to be transferred from the MDA's Agricultural Emergency Revolving Account in the Ag Fund. At the beginning of FY22, the Ag Emergency Fund balance was approximately $426,000. Now preparedness work, as I've mentioned, is essential for a coordinated and efficient response. The MDA has been awarded several federal grants for research and development of operational response plans and novel field trials, which we've carried out over the last couple of years. State funds, these additional state funds could be used to leverage additional grant dollars and to take advantage of opportunities on short notice, but are needed primarily to invest in new and existing resources. Resources such as trained personnel, including our state contractors, specialized and well-maintained depopulation and disposal equipment, surveillance and diagnostic technologies, and that's with partnership with our state veterinary labs. We're looking at biosecurity measures that prevent the spread of disease and exercises to practice those response pieces. And all of that together builds those needed relationships with industry, with academics, other governmental agencies, and tribal partners. So any foreign animal disease response is extremely complex. The Minnesota State Legislature has made building the incident management team possible, and that investment has enabled our group to undertake all of these preparedness efforts for a robust response to HPAI. That's all I have today for the slides. Thank you so much for your attention.
Thank you so very much. Next up, I see we have Bruce Claven, from the Minnesota Turkey Growers Association. Go ahead and identify yourself and share your wisdom with us.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Bruce Clayman, I represent both the Minnesota Turkey Growers Association and the Chicken and Egg Association. I want to thank Ms. Connolly for reaching out to us yesterday and scheduling this, and I want to thank you, Mr. Chairman, for hearing this issue. Probably goes without saying that members of both of our organizations are anxious all day, every day right now in terms of the potential for the outbreak. I'm batting cleanup today. The department's covered the issues very well with their PowerPoints. From the industry side, I would tell you that we are better prepared than we were in 2015 from a biosecurity standpoint, from cleaning boots and buildings, sealing cracks and those kinds of things. And so we're on high alert right now. I would also let the committee know, because your jurisdiction is over both the board and the department in terms of funding, that we support the governor's request of $1.5 million for the emergency fund. And I hope that that can be included sooner rather than later. And I would also say, for the members' benefit, that we work very well in partnership with the board in particular and also the department. We have a good working relationship with them. As you saw on the slides, we're having updates weekly with the regulatory agencies. And Mr. Chairman, I would probably defer to Representative Burkle, who probably knows this better than I do, but in terms of the industry comments, that's what I have for you today, and we'll stand for questions.
Thank you. We have a local expert. Representative Burkle, any thoughts to share?
Yeah, I do. I'll thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks for all the presenters. The only thought I'd share is, and Ms. Hunt said it well, there has been a trust built up among the industry, in particular with the Board of Animal Health over the years, and in particular after 2015, and our preparedness. I would agree with Mr. Clavin's assessment of the industry's preparedness now relative to 15. And I think it's a model we can use that shows industry and the animosity among the farm groups and agencies doesn't have to be there. And I think it could be a model for the deer farm situation we're going to hear soon, I hope, Chair Sundin. And I think there's ways, in particular, as we move into testing protocols and whatnot, that we can use what we've learned in the turkey industry in particular and our relationship with the Board of Animal Health in our goal to somehow fix this deer farm problem. So there's a lot of concern personally, as I've been through this situation myself. And I know that members in our industry are on high alert, as Mr. Clavin said, and I think we'll be okay, but we're about to find out how good our biosecurity plans are.
Thank you. Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I'll be quick. Ms. Hunt, just want to say thank you. You get involved in some things that I suppose really aren't pleasant, you know, dealing with the high path issue in 2015 and then putting down all those hogs a year ago. So thanks for your work. Quick question for Dr. Thompson. Dr. Thompson, you know, I can understand if this high path is being spread by migrating birds and that their droppings get into an outdoor flock. But do we really have any more answers about how this gets inside a closed barn? What is spreading this? Again, thinking back to 2015, it spread rapidly. Any more thoughts or ideas on how this once it gets into an area, spreads so rapidly?
Dr. Thompson, can you help us?
Chair Sundin, Representative Anderson, thank you for that question. And again, we've got a local expert on the call. When he said biosecurity, that's a big part of not spreading the virus around once it's in the environment. What we found in 2015 in the University of Minnesota, researchers have gone through this both in Minnesota and the event as it was down in Iowa. The environment becomes contaminated, and it's very difficult for farmers to move feed, to go into their barns, to do the work that they normally do, keeping in mind that the virus is out on the ground. The virus is probably everywhere that they're walking, everywhere that they're moving. And so biosecurity becomes very important for farmers, for veterinarians, and for all workers on those farms.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Chair Hansen, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I believe Dr. Thompson just raised a very important point, and that is, you know, people can be the vector here. People are the vector. And we can spend time talking about wildlife, but it looks like when you do contact tracing back to 2015, you had people moving around. I think the industry has improved. I think that they've learned from that, but we do still have people moving around. And so biosecurity is really important. We need to look at ourselves and who's on site, who's moving around, and making sure that as we try to contain this, we're thinking about people rather than looking at the wild ducks.
Hey, thank you. We've got a couple minutes left. We've got a question. The number we heard about the economic damage, $650 million, was that an accurate number on the first slide that we saw? Can you someone remind me there? Please.
Lucy, was that on your slide?
Yes, that was. That's the number that we've totaled up in Minnesota alone.
Okay, that was the cleanup and all the efforts that you put forth. How about when that breaks the cycle, the production cycle in those barns? Was that factored into it, you know, the loss of revenue after the fact?
Representative and Chair Sundin and committee members, I can get the breakdown of that number if you'd like. I don't have that in front of me, unfortunately, today, but I can respond to that with some more breakdown.
I'm just thinking the economic damage to the producers might be greater than what was stated. So, I look forward to hearing about that. Any more questions, quickly? Hearing none, seeing none, we're adjourned. Thank you.